Lights, camera, blue light special.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. Call the order, Senate Committee for Judiciary. Just to let you know, as you can see around you, there's a full room. We have a lot of public hearings and possible work sessions today. The way that we've been working these is trying to get those that have fewer people on them testifying out sooner. So for those that are here, and I'll just tell you, the one that's going to be at this point last is 3021. And that's to move the docket, because I've got 8 to 10 bills that we are moving each day, and we just cannot delay these others. So one of the things that would be nice is if you are coming up here to give testimony, shorter is sweeter. And if you have written testimony, please do not try to read it. I will not allow you to read it, but you can summarize it. Tell us from the heart as to what the overall the points are, so we can get the gist. We'll review everything, and then we'll move forward from there. With that, we'll be bouncing around on the schedule. And so let's get started with public hearing on House Bill 2393A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2393A increases fees collected by sheriff's offices for serving legal documents. It's got no revenue impact. A fiscal statement has been issued. It has a subsequent referral to revenue and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. And Brian, I see you're making your way up, and Tammy as well. And is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2393? Whoever would like to get started.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, thank you very much for letting us start first so we can get out of here. For the record, my name is Brian Wallace, and I'm the Chief Civil Deputy at the Marion County Sheriff's Office in Salem. I'm also here on behalf of civil law enforcement professionals throughout the state, the Oregon Sheriffs for Action, and Marion County Sheriff Russ Isham to testify in support of House Bill 2393A, and I thank you. Written testimony has been submitted to be a part of the record. And that said, here is a quick summary of the bill, since you have many other things to attend to. Section 1 to 3 of this bill increases sheriff's fees for service of process and execution of process. Some of those fees haven't been changed since the 1980s. Section 4 to 6, that pertains to internet posting. Sheriff sales, this does not change anything that's already in statute other than all sheriffs must agree to enter into an agreement to maintain one website for the sole purpose of advertising sheriff's execution sales. Section 7 to 8 makes it more clear as to how a sheriff is to proceed when notified of a challenge to a notice of garnishment. Right now, it's crystal clear to us how we're to proceed when we receive a challenge to a writ of garnishment. Notice of garnishment is where state agencies would issue the garnishment, and the statute is very silent on how we are to proceed. And finally, Section 9 through 11 will ensure that a law enforcement agency that seizes a gambling device or fishing equipment will remain the agency that's responsible for the custody and the storage of that equipment, which is better for chain of custody and evidentiary purposes in a criminal case. We've worked with several groups with different sections of this bill, the Oregon Collectors Association, to Oregon State Police for the gambling and the fishing equipment piece. We have all come to agreement, and we hope that you put this through with the due pass recommendation to the floor, and Captain Wood is here as well. I'll turn it over to her. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tammy Wood. I'm with the Linn County Sheriff's Office. I'm also president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Civil Command Council. Just to be real brief, to let you know why we're asking for these increases, other than it's been 6 years ago for some fees, and some fees haven't changed for 23 years. Last fiscal year, my office received over 10,000 papers. We received $137,000 in revenue for service of those papers, but the cost to the citizens of Linn County was over $500,000 above what we took in for revenue to provide this. I figured out the costs, at least in my county, are at least $61 per paper served, and unfortunately we're only asking for $36. I have attached both a revenue expected from counties they were able to, whoever was able to give me the information I've attached, how much they expect to receive it in addition. For my county, it's only $45,000. And also I've attached how the fees compare to the CPI. This was prepared by Legislative Council at the request of the House Revenue Committee. Thank you for your time, and I will entertain any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Boquist.
I have a question of legal counsel first and a question of them. Convey property, what is that?
Convey property?
Right.
Transfer.
Right. Is that a clerk, or why is the sheriff's office in all of that?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, I believe I can answer that. Are you talking about in the sheriff's fees section, conveyance of property?
Correct.
That's for issuance of a sheriff's deed after a sheriff's sale pursuant to a writ of execution.
Okay. Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And I can't find it in the bill, but in the staff measure summary, which Anna did not write, it says, remove the provision authorizing court administrator to establish a website for the purpose of giving legal notice. Why is that in there? Are we eliminating something that's efficient and doing it manually now, or can someone explain that?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, in the laws now, it allows the state court administrator to set up a website for publishing of our sheriff sales, both under real and personal property. That originally came two sessions ago because the Oregon Law Commission had a concern that the sales were not getting enough attendance, because basically we either put them in a newspaper or for personal property we post them in three public places, and generally we don't get a lot of folks coming to the sales. So we ask for that, and it was put into law two sessions ago. However, the state court administrator has not established that website yet, and in our conversations with them, they don't intend to at all. And so since it's something that deals just with sheriff sales, we've asked that that go and have the sheriffs administer the website opposed to the state court administrator.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
Just a point of clarification. And then, so what we're really saying is, instead of the court administrator, what you're asking for is for the sheriffs to have the authority to do it. That's correct?
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, that's correct.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Elsewhere it says, and I'll summarize it, basically if a non-sheriff's department seizes vehicles, fishing gear, so on and so forth like that, they need to retain it until the order is given to turn it over to the local sheriff. The only concern I have there is the question, if you have a local agency, do they even have a place to store it? Are we trying to slow it down, reduce costs, or what's the intent here of rather than turning it over to the local sheriff?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, I do know that particularly Sheriff Dotson has had conversations with Oregon State Police and I believe other jurisdictions in his county for the fishing portion. I don't believe that this would prevent a smaller law enforcement agency from knocking on the sheriff's door and saying, could you please hold this for me? I don't have the storage that's necessary. And I'm very confident that a sheriff would enter into an agreement for that. This is just preventing larger agencies from reading the statute and saying automatically, here's all the stuff you store. It provides really a better chain of custody for the criminal matter. So,
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Regarding the inflation on the rates, I was wondering how that's calculated. My wife typed her master's thesis in geology on a Krona typewriter in 1981 several times, and then paid something like $5 a page to have it done professionally, and now you do it on, do all those sort of things on a on a word processor, and all the forms are on word processors, and so I wonder, was this just a straight calculation off of the CPI, or how was that done? Because if it is off a straight CPI, it's probably not very accurate.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Wissett, it was calculated on the CPI, and basically none of this has to do with word processors versus typewriting. For serving folks, we have to actually go out The costs have risen for not only labor, but gasoline, and for our cars. We didn't figure it. Legislative Council figured it on the CPI at the request of the Revenue Committee on the House side. And in 1981, if it cost us $15 to go out and serve someone, it's now costing us basically $35 to do that based on wages, insurance, cost of cars, cost of gasoline, et cetera.
The question was it calculated by LFO, which led to the fiscal office? Who did you, I mean, in reaching those numbers, what was the process that was used?
It was done by Daybeck at the fiscal office.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you all very much. Again, I'm going to ask, was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2393A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. And we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2393A.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2393A to the floor with a two pass.
This is going to
subsequent referral down.
Ways and means?
Finance and revenue.
To revenue.
Yeah.
Check, just what you said.
All right. Senator Volquist moves House Bill 2393A with the due pass recommendation to the Committee on Revenue for the Senate. And should it go through to the, I guess it would probably go to the President's office for a referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Right.
Andy?
Question, Council. I mean, there's not a state revenue, state fiscal on it. It's a local, is it not?
It's just how it's been sent to us was with.
It had the subsequent referral on it when it came to us.
Yeah.
Unless we want to.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm not a big fan of fees, as everybody knows, but I mean, I know my five sheriff's departments are struggling just to keep deputies on the road.
All right. Any other comments?
Senator, I will support it today. I will reserve the right to read this material before we decide how to vote on the floor.
All right. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment about the website. I know that the intent is to try to get more people to bid, to be there. The more we move away from advertising and newspapers, I think we need to have that discussion maybe over the interim. That's basically the only remaining revenue for newspapers now is advertising. So I don't think it makes sense to continue to advertise in newspapers. I don't think people see those ads, but we need to talk about it in the big picture and what that will do to print media.
I would second that, Mr. Chair. I have counties that don't even have one newspaper.
Okay. Any other comments? Senator Dinkler, do you want to add in?
I like the website. All right. People aren't reading papers, so right. I think that's the best way
objection?
To reach them.
Any objection to the motion before us? So ordered. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2393A. I saw Representative Gessler come in, so we're opening up Gelser. A public hearing on House Bill 2449. And hang on.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2449 requires all health providers, not just physician's assistant or nurse practitioner, evaluating a suspicious injury to a child for possible child abuse to make photographs, clinical notes, diagnostic and testing results available to the county designated medical professional responsible for conducting child abuse investigations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My grandfather, when I got married, told me he remembers it by Gelser rhymes with Alka-Seltzer. Some of you may have found that to be true. House Bill 2449 is a really simple bill. And I can assure you all of these people behind me are not here to talk to you about it. You are being distributed written testimony from the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice. These are two technical fixes to Carley's Law, which we passed in 2007. The first is that Carley's Law requires that a child that's the subject of a child abuse investigation who has suspicious physical injuries receive a medical assessment of those injuries within 48 hours. There has been some confusion in the field about whether or not if the investigator is certain that the injuries are caused by child abuse, whether or not the child still needs medical attention. This clarifies that, yes, if the child is injured, the child still needs medical attention, even if you're certain it was caused by child abuse. The second is that because of the timing on this, some children end up going to an emergency room if there is not a slot opened at the assessment center, the regional assessment center that does these examinations. In that case, in the circumstance where the physician does the examination and ultimately the investigation results in an unsubstantiated allegation of abuse, there is a problem with reimbursing the hospital for the provision of service. This allows that to be reimbursed even if the abuse is unfounded. That's all the bill does. Two quick technical fixes. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I urge you to move the bill.
All right. Any questions for the representative? Senator Wessup.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Representative Gelser, has there been any effort to actually fund this process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, yes, there has been an effort to fund this process. I had a couple of bills this session to address that issue. However, generally, there are reimbursements for the examinations themselves. They are generally funded by the child's insurance, by the Oregon Health Plan, or by the Crime Victims Assistance Fund when they go in. So this is not uncompensated care. And when we passed the bill last session, Legislative Fiscal Office determined what was happening. Kids were getting the examinations. They just weren't being included as part of the child abuse investigation. This pulled the medical team into that child abuse investigation team.
I would certainly agree this is something that needs to be done. I would not necessarily agree that it's currently being funded in an adequate manner. There's a lot of volunteer help going in. A lot of physicians are putting a lot of time in for nothing in order to get this done.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I would agree we need to invest much more significantly in our child abuse assessment and advocacy centers and in child abuse prevention generally. I am very pleased with the impact of Carly's Law. I received a letter from the Klamath County CARES who was able to describe two cases in particular where they feel that this bill may have saved a child's life. So I think we have more work to do on these issues, but I think that overall it's been a net good.
And I can show you a file of letters asking for us to get more money for them.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Just checking to see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2449. Not seeing anyone. We close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 2449.
Mr. Chairman, HB 2449A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2449 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions, objections, discussions? Any objection? None. All right, so ordered. Volunteer Senator Wissett will be the carrier, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2449, and we'll open up our next public hearing, which is going to be on House Bill 2139A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2139A allows DHS to petition a court ex parte for preliminary appointment of a trustee if there's immediate risk of harm or death to the patients in the facility. This one has no revenue impact. It has a fiscal impact statement. The House rescinded the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It did have one in the House, but they rescinded it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mary, were you going to go first?
Okay.
Committee, for the record, my name is Mary Gere. I'm the Administrator for Licensing and Quality of Care in the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. I'm here today to testify in support of 2139A. This is a bill requested by the Governor on behalf of the Department. This bill seeks to expand the tools that we have for dealing with emergency situations, for example, when providers walk away or feel they can no longer provide care in residential facilities, assisted living, and nursing facilities. We had a situation recently where we needed to address this kind of issue, and so this bill creates an expedited process for trustees, expands our current trustee statute, and also creates a temporary manager authority. We've worked very hard with the Oregon Healthcare Association. Appreciate their collaboration on creating adequate protections for providers and due process. And as stated, this does have a fiscal impact in that we're expanding, we're raising the cap on the amount in the trustee fund from the current $300,000 to $750,000. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lauren Rhodes with the Oregon Healthcare Association, and just wanted to confirm that we worked very closely with the department and found consensus on all of the provisions in this bill and are very supportive of it and encourage you to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for any of our panelists? Ladies, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2139A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 2139A.
Move HB 2139A to the floor with a due pass, and I'll speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2139A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did question both the agency and the OHCA in regards to the fiscal. And this is very similar to the Forest Fire Fund, where it's an industry fund that's put together in case an emergency comes up. And since they're all on board, I'm perfectly fine with this.
All right. Any other comments, questions? All right. With that, any objection to the motion? So order. And do we have a volunteer for Senator Boquist will be our carrier for House Bill 2686. And we'll close.
2139A.
Wrong one.
I don't know what 86 is.
That's next. That's 2139A. We'll close the work session on 2139A. And then the preview for the next bill is going to be House Bill 2686. Public hearings opened up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2686 adds pharmacists to the list of officials required to report child abuse. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Record, my name is Dan Kennedy, and I'm a pharmacist at the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. Today, I'm here representing the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. Hopefully, this will be incredibly brief. This bill does a very simple thing. It adds pharmacists to the list of public and private officials that are required as mandatory reporters of child abuse in the state of Oregon. I see this really as an omission of pharmacists. We are a very ethical profession. We have very good access to the public. The public has very good access to us. So really all this does is add pharmacists to the same list in which nurses and chiropractors and optometrists and other healthcare professionals are lined. So that's it in a nutshell, and I would ask for your support of this, please.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, are there any questions for Mr. Kennedy? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2686? Not seeing one, we'll close the public hearing.
Mr. Chair,
open a work session on House Bill 2686.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2686 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2686 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. Volunteer on this one.
It's a great
Senator
one.
Senator Wissett's going to pick up the slack on this one. Thank you very much. I have to keep that. That's two right now, so we'll have to balance these out. All right, so close the work session on House Bill 2686, which means we're now opening up a work session on House Bill 2655.
Public hearing.
Public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2655 prohibits a person from obtaining the property of a mass transit district by adverse possession. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Good morning, Olivia.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet, and with me is Eric Van Hagen from our legal department. Mr. Chairman and committee members, this, again, is a pretty simple bill. It basically clarifies in the statute that TriMet and transportation districts in Oregon have the same protection from adverse possession that cities, counties, railroads, school districts, other public agencies have. In a nutshell, to use Dan's phrase, basically what this does is protect us from someone who may build a fence or chicken coop or something into our right-of-way. If we don't catch that within a 10-year period, then we're not protected from adverse possession. We own a lot of right-of-way, a rail right-of-way, and going to own more throughout the three-county region, and we don't necessarily patrol the property lines on a regular basis, so we would like to make sure that we have this protection in the statute. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Eric, did you have anything you were going to add to the testimony, or just here for questions?
Just available for questions.
All right, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there really chicken coops allowed?
Yes.
Actually, Ms. Longerman, Senator Boquist, you can have, in the city of Portland, you can have a certain number of
three
chickens. Yes.
Three. No roosters.
Well, I guess the city of Salem needs to catch up.
I have a real question, Mr. Chair.
That was a real question.
Condemnation for chicken coops.
Yeah. All right. For Senator Boquist, got a, you know, for his information, we have a place out in the South Hills, and actually we hear a rooster crowing each morning.
Okay. So welcome.
Illegal rooster.
All right.
I do have a real question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you. Has this been an issue, or is this preventative? In other words, have you had to deal with this? If so, how many instances are you anticipating it could be
Mr.
an issue
Chairman,
one day?
Senator Dingfelder, not to my knowledge. It could become an issue in the future, but I'm not aware of anything right now.
Thank you.
Chicken coops might expand.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2655? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on 2655 and open a work session on House Bill 2655.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2655 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2655 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I'd like to hear it.
Okay. All right, here's how we're doing this. We're going to have co-carriers for this big deal here.
No.
Senator Dingfelder and Senator Boquist. Y'all can fight over on the floor. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2655. And we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing. This is going to be on House Bill 2349A.
2349A. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2349A clarifies that an interest earned on a surety bond filed with the county goes to the person who filed the bond, creates a process for the county and the court to follow in releasing a lien and returning a surety bond. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, I've got four individuals who want to give testimony, so let's see. Alex? Okay, yeah, I want to, you know, you're three, and then I saw Alex Kyler, but I don't see him in. So why don't you do three, come on up, and if Alex comes back in, we'll get him on in the next one. Alex, why don't you grab a chair and come up and join the panel, please? Yes, we are. And whoever would like to get started.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Shelby Rahala, Government Affairs, Washington County. The original concept of House Bill 2349 was to shift to the function of holding construction liens.
So our response in the Ingram bill is, if we have to have this function, how do we make it better? So the representatives from Lane and Marion counties will speak directly to the problems that we've had with these withholding these liens, and this is our response to those. We came up with four main provisions that are reflected in this bill. First is clarifying the depositor's entitlement to the interest earned on the deposited funds. Second, ensuring the counties will not be improperly brought into the suit to foreclose the lien. Three, describing the contents of the court's order to disperse the funds.
and four, establishing a process for the county treasurer to follow when releasing the lien or in the event that a court's order is unclear. House Bill 2349A passed the House floor unanimously on the consent calendar, and we ask for your support here today.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Steele, and I'm the Marion County Treasurer, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2349. I just wanted to give you a couple examples of some of the problems that the counties are facing under the current statutes that lack a lot of direction in the disbursement of funds that have been deposited with our office. We have had numerous claims for disbursement of funds where the information provided to counties has not been accurate, and the counties are then liable for the monies that were inaccurately dispersed based on the information received. This bill would provide a lot of clarification so that that would not happen any longer. We have some deposits right now in my office because of the number of claims existing in the courts. My legal counsel has been unable to determine the accurate disposition of the funds. Therefore, we're not able to disperse the funds, and we're probably waiting until the claimants sue the county to get that money. We'll end up spending more money in legal fees than the amount that's been deposited in my office currently. My office tends to average about 6 to 10 liens a year, anywhere from $100,000 to $250,000 involved every year. I know Multnomah County recently had as many as 8 liens filed or deposited in their office, just under $1 million. There are some counties that have never had construction liens filed at their offices, and they wouldn't know what to do with them if they arrived. So we've been working with the Oregon Association of County Treasurers to develop some information that we can provide to all the county treasurers on how to act. But this bill would really provide a lot of clarity that the current statute is lacking and resolve a lot of the issues that we have and a lot of costs that we go through to determine how to disperse the funds.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and I'd just echo the story from Marion County. We, too, have a number of these filings each year, and recently our financial services manager was named in a lawsuit. The treasurer is actually our management services director, but they were able to find the financial services manager name off of the website and named her in the lawsuit instead. And that involved then, it was a dispute between two contractors over a $100,000 lien. The county council was involved. The court order was less than clear in terms of the distribution, and upon distribution, there was another disagreement, and then so county council had to get re-involved in the case as a result of how the money was ultimately distributed. So you can sort of see how these get pretty messy and eat up a lot of time and attorney costs for Lane County and other counties potentially. Thank you.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties. This bill will make the process clearer. It'll allow us to settle the disputes quicker and minimize the need for lawsuits. That means there's going to be less aggravation, time saved, and money saved. For that reason, AOC supports the bill. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2349A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. And we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2349A.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2349A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2349A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And
you
want to take this one? All right, Senator Bonamici will be our carrier for House Bill 2349A. We'll close that work session. And we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing. And going back on kind of the calendar, that's going to be House Bill 3021A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3021A is the Oregon Law Commission bill on emergency liability for volunteers. And there are several amendments, I believe, the proponents of the bills and other people testifying will be talking about today. It is not ready to move.
Right. And as we've been sitting here, I think we've picked up another 3 to 4 amendments. So we're only waiting to see how many more might be here. So
Lane, Greg, and Wendy, all three come up. Is there anyone besides the three would make up your panel or just work this? Okay, that works.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your hearing on House Bill 3021 this morning. My name is Lane Shetterly. I'm here as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, and I will be very brief today because I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Representative McPherson, who chaired the work group on House Bill 3021, who will speak to you in more detail about it. Wendy has further information, and we also will touch on those amendments. You've got several amendments, but happily, they all focus on the same issue. So it's going to present you with a policy choice that you can make. So it's not going to be a scattershot, and it's a good one. You'll enjoy wrestling with this little policy issue, and we're happy to bring it to you this morning. Mr. Chair, I will be very brief this morning and turn it over to Representative McPherson. Let him give you the overview, and then Wendy has a bit more detail.
Thank you, Lane. For the record, Chair Przanski, I'm Greg McPherson, member of the Oregon Law Commission. And
also a member of the county team that just, I think, lost by 30 minutes to the capital punishment team.
It wasn't 30.
It wasn't 30, but I have to confess, Mr. Chair, that it was
10.
Ten minutes.
Oh, that's the lobby. The lobby lost by 30 minutes.
35. But it did happen to present me participating in the peddling leg opposite Senator Atkinson, who was a former professional bicycle racer, and needless to say, he came in substantially ahead of me.
Well, you notice they scratched me from that position and brought in the ringer.
The ringer, right.
Another year we'll come roaring back. The House Bill 3021 is aimed to solve the problem of how do we make sure we don't have disincentives for volunteerism in our state. We depend on the work of volunteers in Oregon to get a whole lot of service to the public performed. And in particular, this is a concern in the area of search and rescue and of emergency medical treatment. The work group formed by the Law Commission determined was that there are two areas of potential disincentive. One is the potential for claims of for liability against people who volunteer in an emergency situation. And the other is the lack of clarity as to when they are covered by workers' compensation insurance to provide treatment for any injuries they might sustain while they perform that volunteer service. The solution the Law Commission work group that I served on developed is to clarify the Oregon Tort Claims Act to provide, which already provides that agents of a public entity are covered by the Tort Claims Act and will be indemnified by the public body for any claims brought against them, but it is not clear under current law just when somebody is an agent of the public entity for that purpose. So House Bill 3021 clarifies that by establishing that they have to be pre-registered either as an individual or an organization, or they have to be acknowledged in writing at the scene, which could be done if people show up, for example, for a search and rescue operation, or if they're a member of the Oregon State Defense Force, then they would be automatically within the scope of those protections. So in effect, it regulates and controls who can be extended the protections of liability under the Tort Claims Act or workers' compensation. And it also requires that they have to be acting within the scope of their duties, and in the case of medical services, within the protocols established by the state, so they are actually carrying out some public function. So the purpose of this is to clarify and regulate so that we know when people are subject to these protections and when they're not. And we're mindful in this process that that extending both indemnification from a public entity and workers' comp coverage has a price tag associated with it, and so the public entity is then in control of that decision, particularly with respect to the policy choice that Law Commission Chair Shetterly just alluded to, which is the question of of whether the counties in particular with respect to search and rescue operations should be allowed to substitute for workers' compensation coverage, health insurance coverage. It was the original proposal of the Law Commission and the bill as introduced that it would be limited to workers' comp coverage. So they either register the individual or acknowledge them at the scene of a search and rescue operation and take on responsibility for them or not, and if they do, then they have workers' compensation coverage, not a health insurance alternative. I'm going to defer now to Wendy Johnson, the very able staff attorney for the Law Commission, to add any further detail to that policy choice and any points I may have missed in describing the bill.
Chair Krasinski, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, General Counsel and Deputy Director for the Law Commission. Representative McPherson has done a good overview of the bill. I just want to focus in on a couple of other issues. This committee is very familiar with the Clark case and the Tort Claims Act Task Force, and I just want to make sure that you understand that the request to do this project came before Clark and came before the task force and also before the Vaughn case. But this bill does not, it's our understanding in discussions with legislative counsel and all the attorneys on the work group, that this bill does not conflict with Clark or the Vaughn case or with the task force recommendations. Rather, as Representative McPherson explained, that when we look at agent, which is what the Tort Claims Act uses, it covers employees and agents and officers of the state, agent hadn't been defined until the Vaughn case came out and gave a common law definition explanation. This bill will now say, it doesn't conflict with it, it's just another definition in statute that says for the purposes of volunteers, when we're talking about emergencies, if they do this, this, and this, they will be an agent for the purposes of the Tort Claims Act, then the rest of the Tort Claims Act still applies. So that means the restrictions on the Tort Claims Act and the immunities that are provided in the Tort Claims Act, that this would still dovetail. It's just that when a volunteer shows up at the scene and they ask, well, what happens if I, you know, unintentionally hurt someone and then I'm sued in tort, what will happen? And the counties and the state didn't have a great explanation, because you had to, well, if you're an agent, you'll be okay. But, well, how do I know if I'm an agent? And this bill will delineates that and says if you're registered, if you're or acknowledged in writing at the scene and you're directed by the county or the state to do these volunteer activities, then you will get this Tort Claims Act protection. The two stumbling blocks to volunteer help are fear of liability, of injuring others and hurting them, or in fear of hurting themselves and what will happen to me because my, you know, I may not have insurance, or what if I'm disabled, or et cetera. The work group made a decision to require workers' compensation for both state declared emergency volunteers as well as search and rescue volunteers. I should back up and say Chapter 401 is a really large chapter that's very confusing, but it covers all kinds of emergencies. The big state declared emergency as well as 911, which may be just your specific emergency, as well as search and rescue emergencies that are happening day to day. And part of this recommendation is to clean up that whole chapter so folks understand where they fit into the chapter, and a lot of the stuff will move to a different chapter so it's not as confusing. But in short, workers' comp was considered the best remedy for a volunteer who is directed by government to assist, whether it be in a state declared emergency or search and rescue, because as you know, workers' comp covers injuries, it provides medical coverage, but it also provides time loss and it also provides disability. It attempts to make the volunteer whole. And while it is a potential cost, we never know exactly how many volunteers we're going to need in a given year, because we don't know when that earthquake or tsunami will hit. Oregon can't afford not to have enough volunteers who are willing to assist, because the alternative would be to have to pay people to have ready to go all the time, and then they would be employees, and we know that employees have workers' comp insurance, or workers' comp coverage, rather. So this bill provides it for the state declared emergency volunteers and the search and rescue volunteers. So then to get to the specifics of where the contention is the Dash 4 amendments focus on Section 14, and all the other amendments that you have before you today, I believe, are on that same Section 14. What Section 14 does is it says to counties who have the responsibility for search and rescue activities. The sheriff is the person who directs the search and rescue activity in a county. And I just want to, as a side note, that we did have a sheriff on our work group from Klamath County, Sheriff Evinger, and we also had several search and rescue members on our work group. Counties have this task of search and rescue. It's not the state. So when a county deploys a search and rescue worker or search and rescue volunteer, the bill as originally put in by the commission would require workers' comp coverage for that volunteer. In the House, it was amended to require workers' compensation coverage or medical insurance. It was a split vote in the House committee on that issue, and ultimately the issue of cost, what it would cost for the few counties that don't provide workers' comp, instead who provide medical insurance, won the day. That vote went to put in the amendment or medical insurance. Then the bill caught the attention of MLAC, the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and that committee met on Friday and voted unanimously to oppose the bill if it contained that or language or medical insurance. They opposed it for several reasons, largely because it doesn't provide adequate coverage. Workers' comp comes with an exclusive remedy, as you know. We know under the remedies clause of the Constitution that if you provide workers' comp, then that's a trade-off that you now can't be sued in tort. MLAC felt very strongly that that's an important incentive from a risk management perspective to not have that risk continue on the county for search and rescue activities. If you provide medical insurance, you don't get that exclusive remedy. There are a variety of other reasons, but suffice to say, they do not like that or language and would oppose the bill if it remains in there. They gave two options to fix the problem with the bill. Would either delete the or language, which is what the dash four does and requires workers' comp, or delete the section altogether. Some of the amendments before you today do other things, but I just want to advise the committee that MLAC has stated it's one of those two choices would be the only way they would have supported at this point. So it is a policy choice before you. You have letters from search and rescue volunteers who could not be here today. Rob Cruikshank was a member of our work group, and you also have a letter from Tacoma, one of their search and rescue groups, noting the problem that Oregon has when it doesn't provide workers' comp to its search and rescue volunteers. There's becoming a greater awareness that if you don't have workers' comp, you could be seriously injured, and that there is no recourse for that injured worker, and it will cut down on the number of people who are willing to volunteer. Those are the two big areas. There's another area that has to do with hospitals. Chapter 401 already provided immunity for hospitals in a governor-declared emergency if they were following the directives of the state. It didn't even have that directive part. If it was a governor-declared emergency, hospitals had immunity. It wasn't very clear what immunity they had or what protections they had. The bill narrows it and says you get immunity if you're doing something the government tells you to do, but it had to be the hospital if it was they were volunteering. When you have a big declared emergency, you don't know whether the person who's walking in the door really has insurance or not, and so this deletes that compensation issue. Says to the hospital, if you are doing what the government tells you to do, and it has to be specific, it's a declared emergency and you're doing emergency services. If, for example, DHS tells you you need to take care of these people and do it this way and provide ventilators to these people, if you are then sued in tort for that, you would have immunity because you were acting pursuant to the government's directive. That's also in the bill. And then lastly, we do amend the Tort Claims Act, but it's only a small piece. It just says that an emergency is not the occurrence. Those of you who work for the Tort Claims Act understand that the limits that are set for the state and the local government are per occurrence, and we just wanted to make sure that it's not the tsunami that's the occurrence. It's the actions of those individuals that are an occurrence that would trigger each cap. So it's a pretty... I think it passes the blush test, but it just was wanted to be made crystal clear that that's what occurrence means. And with that, I would take any questions.
All right. Questions for anyone on the panel? All right. First, we'll start Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And anybody can answer this question. On the A5 amendment, I guess we have the A4, the A5, the A8, the A9. I guess the first question is there is a little bit different issue other than the workman's comp and insurance, so I want to get rid of that. The A5 appears to be addressing, for the most part, that reimbursement for emergency services, volunteer food lodging, is not compensation or remuneration. Is that just an oversight in the original bill, or is that a substantive change
Mr. Chair, would you like me to respond to that?
Sure.
My understanding is the A5 amendments is making clear that there is not a remuneration, because if there is, that means workers' comp must be provided to a worker. So if you have a volunteer for a county and you're giving them any of these things, and they will have to be covered in workers' comp. I think the A5 amendments were from people who didn't want to have to cover workers' comp. They wanted to do it with insurance.
So follow up to counsel, that then if the policy choice is either or, then we need to have the A5 to provide the coverage for either or.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Vogel, and if you go with the A4s, you don't need A5s.
Right. Mr. Chair, I'd like to address Senator Vogel's question. The reason that there's already a provision already in the bill to make sure that if we provide pizzas to the volunteer firefighters, that that's okay. But there's also the issue of medical insurance. If you provide medical insurance, that is remuneration. So it was put into that amendment because if you keep the medical insurance in there, you need to make sure that medical insurance is not remuneration, because then you'd have to provide both medical insurance and workers' comp, because medical insurance would be remuneration, and anytime you have remuneration given, Chapter 656 clicks in, and now you have to have workers' comp.
Okay. Before we go further, I want to get a program, let's say, for the amendments. The A4s are basically from the proponents of the bill, meaning the law commission.
Mr. Chair, they would restore the bill to the form in which it was introduced. That's correct. And it mandates workers' compensation is the only provision for volunteers.
All right. And the A5s are from Clackamas, I understand?
I believe they're from Clackamas County.
Okay. I'm just going to... And my understanding, and that is one that would be for having the either or at least have the or
that,
the insurance.
Right, lets them have the.
All right, and then the eights, do we know where they're from?
No, I don't know anything about
the eights. You'll get testimony on that.
Right, and the A9s, I'm assuming we'll get those later too. Okay. We're just getting our program set. All right, Senator Boquist.
Next question. And if one of the two lawyers wants to jump into this, or maybe we need to get Safe to answer the question.
That would be one of those three lawyers.
Three lawyers. My question is on the workman's comp. I mean, I'm very familiar with workman's comp, obviously, because I have policies in the state of Oregon. I'm also very familiar with the restrictions SAFE has in who it can provide policy coverage to from out of the state who come into the state. And so I'm a little concerned that that you're limiting choices. If you say workers' comp only, you're limiting the choices of where you can get workers' comp. And the second thing, you're still limiting the choices of what search and rescue teams can come here. Can you address who would be covered under the workers' comp?
Let me do this. I think what I'm going to ask, and Chris, I don't know if you're hearing the questions. If you are, if you'd like to bring a chair up and just be here. He's not scheduled. He's just been monitoring, from my understanding. But if we're getting into that, at least we can get a perspective
right.
of someone that's a
good
provider.
Chair Prezanski, I think I can answer that question.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, Jerry Manahan, sir.
They're not signed up.
But they're here.
Okay, so they're here too. Okay. Sorry, I didn't see Lou in the room either. Okay. So whoever wants to handle the question, I just want to make sure we have enough people here to be able to respond.
Dansky, my understanding of that question, the answer would be that most of these out-of-state folks who come in, we have a mutual aid agreement that says if you're hurt, the agency that where you're coming from will cover your injuries, but where you're helping will cover the tort side of it. And it's just an equity issue that if... they just want to make sure that they're going to get the same protections from county to county and state to state. And presently, Oregon doesn't provide workers' comp for consistently across the state for its volunteers. But my understanding is that the folks in Washington may be mistaken on what they would get for coverage, because it's usually if they hurt themselves, it's the state where they came from. But if they injure somebody else, the tort goes to the asking party. That's how those agreements work, because of this very issue of you can't have workers' comp out of state kind of issues.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. I hadn't signed up because I hadn't seen these amendments until they were just handed out a couple of minutes ago, and I will have comments on the A8 amendment. But specifically to Senator Boquist's question, and the law generally is that if somebody comes into the state from another state and they were hired to work in that other state, then the other state is the where the workers' compensation insurance would be placed or where it would be provided. If somebody is hired specifically to work in Oregon, then you have to purchase Oregon workers' compensation insurance. And there are representatives from the Department of Consumer and Business Services in the audience, too, and they could address that also.
Follow up, sure.
Yes.
So then, in your case, I'll use an example, which I know you and I have actually discussed very firmly. Let's say that someone from Montana, where we have no reciprocal agreement, where SAFE cannot provide insurance in Montana, comes to Oregon in one of these emergencies, provide services as an injured, and in Montana, let's say hypothetically, they don't have workers' compensation coverage. They're not going to be covered in Montana, and they're not going to be covered in Oregon in either one. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, we are talking about volunteers here who, under current law, of course, are not required to be covered. So I assume your question is, if this bill were to pass and workers' compensation insurance was required, my guess would be that if they came from a state where there was no requirement to have that coverage, and perhaps most other states would not have an obligation to provide coverage for volunteers, then it would probably be necessary for, I guess I don't know the answer to that, because if they're not employed by the, or volunteers that are recruited directly by the county, then I'm not sure who would have the obligation to provide that coverage. Perhaps DCBS could respond to that.
Follow up for later, Mr. Chair. And I'll use a real, Wyoming's a prime example. I mean, Wyoming is not required to have the workers come, but not for a fact. And SAFE cannot provide coverage for Wyoming workers because SAFE was restricted. If the county had a SAFE policy versus, say, Liberty mutual policy, you've got all kinds of compounded problems here. And I think that needs to be answered at least on some of these amendments at some future point, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, we're going to be, let's say, moving through this at slower speeds, as you can imagine, with everything that's before us. And Wendy, then I've got other people who want to ask questions. I got two more panels, if not three.
Chair Przanski, Senator Boquist, there is one exception that Wyoming, I believe, is one of the signatories to the EMAC, the Emergency Management Compact, which covers employees of the state who volunteer in another state. That requires workers' comp. So the gap is only volunteers who are not employees of a state who are sent. And that is just an issue that wasn't our focus. We were trying to get our own state volunteers protected, because right now they do have better protection if they go help. If our own state employees go help in Louisiana, they have protection. But if our own volunteers help in Oregon, they don't have protection. That was one of the main requests for the bill that came from DHS and OEM, is that recognize that we've got these federal acts covering people, but we don't have our own act to cover Oregon. So we can still get assistance from another state, but it's they're purely volunteer. They're not an employee that's volunteering. There is a gap.
All right. Senator, is that all for now?
That's all, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
It doesn't answer my question, but it's all.
All right. Senator Bonamici next.
I'm going to pass. I'll wait for the other
Senator
panel.
Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Krasinski. I have two questions. One regarding the workers' compensation. It's my understanding, my experience, that workers' compensation is based on the risk of the profession, the work experience as a percentage of the compensation. So how do you figure it on a volunteer in a unspecified situation?
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, the workers' compensation system premium is based on classifications of employment where people of similar risk are grouped
yes.
together. It is possible now for counties to elect to cover search and rescue volunteers. SAFE insures 16 of the 36 counties, and 12 of the 16 who we insure have elected to provide workers' compensation coverage for search and rescue. They're included in a classification that includes regular full-time employees as well as volunteers, and typically it includes security, patrols, investigators, watchmen, those kinds of classifications. So we, for the coverage that we provide today, there is an assumed wage, which is then used as the basis for calculating the premium.
Thank you. Second question for Wendy. I thought I heard you say that regarding the hospital liability, that they would be indemnified for liability, and as long as the government told them what to do and they followed followed those directions, that does not give me a warm feeling. Given that many of the Department of Human Services employees are not licensed in the state to even in their own profession, I'm not at all certain that we should be having the state telling the medical professionals in a hospital how to handle their cases. Or perhaps I misunderstood you.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, it's Section 9 of the bill. This was existing law that immunity was provided to health care providers. We're talking about hospitals. And this is a public health emergency or governor-declared emergency. And it's... hospital facility, and in those situations, then it's declared emergency. There is Tort Claims Act protection, but we're not talking about DHS generally. It's authority already in statute to make these directives and guidelines, and it's pursuant to those guidelines that the hospital would be acting. Only in that situation, then, would the facility have Tort Claims Act protection.
But Mr. Chair, if I could maybe respond to Senator Witz's question. It sounded like there was a concern that perhaps the bill expanded the authority of state or local government to tell medical service providers how to do their job. And it doesn't do that. It just says that if, to the extent the medical service provider is departing or not operating within protocols that are set by the public entity, then they don't have the Tort Claims Act protection. So they would be covered in effect by their own insurer, when, to the extent they're not acting within a protocol or direction from the public entity.
So that only I understand they'd still be able to do whatever they wanted to do within their own insurance, but if they're going to be insured under the Tort Act, the State Tort Act, the Tort Liability Act, then they would still have to, their efforts would be restricted by the direction of the government then?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, to have the indemnification under the Tort Claims Act,
yes,
they'd have to be operating within direction or protocols prescribed by the public entity rather than deciding what to do on their own. And I think that's the logic of that is that the all the taxpayers of the state or of the local jurisdiction shouldn't be responsible for covering the risks that arise from that conduct by the medical service provider unless the medical service provider is acting in accordance with direction they're getting from a public jurisdiction.
And if I may, too, just offer Grant Higginson is here and may be able to expand on this as well, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt. I think one of the issues, one of the reasons for this also is to limit that tort claims protection to services that are provided pursuant to an emergency declaration. So if, for instance, the facility is designated as a critical care center in the event of a SARS outbreak or something like that, and so it occurs, but at the same time, there's a gallbladder surgery that's scheduled and going on at the same time. It has nothing to do with the declaration of emergency. The point of this is that gallbladder surgery that's not being provided pursuant to any declaration of emergency relative to this SARS outbreak doesn't come under the tort claims limitation. So that what is covered for tort claims purposes are services that are provided relative to that declaration of emergency. Again, the point being that the hospital has its own insurance for those kinds of services,
That's really not the question, Lane. The question was basically, I understand that, but under the Tort Claims Act, under the tort claims coverage, would the medical professionals in the hospital be required to do things a certain way in order to treat these individuals, or are you just saying they're limited? The Tort Claim Act would just be limited to treating people that are injured as a result of this emergency, or are sick because of SARS. I mean, are we having the government tell the medical professionals how to do their work, or just whom they can perform their work on. That's the point.
Let me just frame it. What I'm hearing is basically procedure. Is the procedure that the physician wants to follow, or are we going to be dictating the actual procedure they have to follow as compared to the protocol, which I am picking up that we're dealing with this population for this purpose and basically go for it, and of course they're going to be within the realm of whatever procedures they know and how they would act or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, again, I think maybe Dr. Higginson can give you better. I think my understanding, and I think I'm correct in this, is that this does not expand the Department of Human Services or Governor's Office authority. This just clarifies the circumstances under which that tort claims liability protection will come into play under this bill. So I don't think this bill expands the authority.
I've got the next panel. We'll have Dr. Higginson there plus the other individual at the state. So what I'm going to do is, Chris, I'm going to have you step back, and I know that Jerry Manahan and Lou Savage are here. What we're going to do is y'all are going to wait to the end and do cleanup, because I've got these other amendments coming in, and I think we can wrap everything up easier that way instead of having you coming back and forth. All right, with that, my next panel is going to be Ken Murphy, Grant Higginson, and Paul Evans.
Dr. Higginson had to leave for Sheriff Krasansky.
Oh.
In another meeting.
Okay.
Sheriff Krasansky, members of the committee. My testimony on this is very brief. I'm Paul Evans with Governor Kulongoski's office, policy advisor for military and veterans affairs. And quite frankly, the core of this bill is a priority. I understand there's 8 or 9 amendments. I'll leave it to the wisdom of the legislature to sort through those things. But my message is this. In the post-Katrina world, we had the time to look at holes in the emergency response framework. And this is a problem. It's a significant problem. The work done by the panel, the work done by the committee to get the bill this far needs to be applied. It's on the right direction. I understand the finer points need to be understood. But there are a couple of things that I want to emphasize. This is in the worst-case scenario. When a governor's declaration is intended, when resources are limited, when transportation systems may be non-existent, and we're in a situation where we are asking doctors and medical personnel to do things
that they may be loath to do. When things get bad, as
Senator Boquist knows from experience, you have to ration things sometimes, or you have to try experimental fixes sometimes if you can't get other things there. And what the intent of this bill is to do really is twofold. One, for the medical community that's involved in the emergency itself, again, not the delivering baby down the hall, but rather in the emergency itself, to give them a little bit of cover if we're asking them to do things that are not their normal protocol. The second piece is for volunteers, again, good people wanting to do good things to help out, to make sure that they're not hurt and that they have to carry the price of trying to be a good person and a helpful person the rest of their lives. How we do that, again, leave in your hands. But the fact that this needs to be solved as soon as we can is, from the governor's office, very important. This is an opportunity that we know now is a problem, and if we don't get it solved, we think that there's bigger problems down the road. So I'll stop with that.
Okay. Thank you. Ken?
Thank you, Chair Krasansky, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy, the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and I was a member of the work group that worked on this. And I will just add to this that it's really trying, as Mr. Evans stated and as the other panel before, to address the issues dealing with volunteerism, across our state. I also sit on the Governor's Search and Rescue Council, and that's been a number one issue since the day that council has started in working with our search and rescue people. And in today's world of these disasters, no matter how small they are or how big they are, we truly depend on volunteers. I think this bill, as you've heard from the previous panel, helps to clarify how they're covered, gives them, you know, an opportunity for more protection. I think also the bill gives the public bodies more of a chance and authority and more focus to try and identify all the volunteers that we may have in a jurisdiction by name, good training programs, credentialing of those volunteers so that we do have better qualified volunteers such as they do in search and rescue now. Each one of the sheriff's office have different types of training and credentialing plans so that we know these people, know their jobs, and are prepared to do that. As public health has done the same thing with their volunteer registry of healthcare professionals, we do the same thing in our office as county emergency managers, also dealing with even amateur radio volunteers. So we're trying to look at the whole spectrum of all of the different folks that volunteer for this. So I think this strengthens and encourages volunteerism in Oregon and will strengthen Oregon's position in ultimately providing safety to the citizens and visitors of the state.
All right, thank you. Question, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. Gentlemen, I think what I just heard is that the policy discussion is really going back and forth. Is do you provide a workman's comp or do you provide him insurance? I think what I heard you gentlemen just say is if you do one or the other or both, that's our decision. You're fine with that. We just need to do something and pass the rest of the bill.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Boquist, you're correct. I'm not an expert on workman's comp or medical insurance or any of those. I would say it is in your hand as a committee on how to deal with this, but I think the right thing to do is to provide them the best possible coverage so that those men and women, when they do volunteer, you know, have the ability to protect themselves.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any, so thank you all very much. My next panel is going to be Ross Fleshman and Scott Bellows. Gentlemen.
Good morning. I'm Ross Fleshman, the emergency physician with Portland Mountain Rescue. Thank you, Senator Brzezinski, for 2 minutes to speak on behalf of Portland Mountain Rescue in support of House Bill 3021, which supports search and rescue volunteers as we provide a necessary service to your constituents. Now, while it's the high-profile rescues high on Mount Hood that draw the most media attention, they're just a tiny part of what we do for the well-being of all Oregonians. We find lost children and Alzheimer's patients. We help law enforcement with evidence searches. And we help people who get into trouble in more common outdoor activities, such as hikers. And these are necessary services, and as search and rescue is the legal responsibility of the counties, this bill will continue to save local governments money by ensuring that these services are provided on a volunteer basis. Now, the cost of extending workers' comp coverage is small compared to the value of the free service that we provide. It's also the right thing to do. Why carry personal medical and disability coverage? My disability insurance specifically excludes injuries sustained while climbing. So if I were injured while performing a rescue like those of this weekend on Mount Hood, my family would be unprotected by the coverage that I have. It's only fair that if I'm performing the work that's legally required to be performed through the sheriff, I should have the same type of workers' comp coverage as would a sheriff's deputy who was injured in the line of duty. We feel the House amendment substituting medical coverage for workers' comp are not an acceptable alternative for three reasons. First, coverage would likely be inadequate with no disability requirement and no minimum level of medical coverage. Secondly, it doesn't address the problem of the out-of-state teams who are reluctant to come because of the lack of the workers' comp coverage that they enjoy at home. And finally, medical coverage alone does not protect the counties from suits by an injured volunteer in the way that workers' comp coverage does. So I urge you to support Amendment Number 4, reinstating workers' compensation coverage to search and rescue volunteers in in summary, this will ensure continued cost savings to local governments and will rightly extend workers' comp coverage to those volunteers who provide this valuable free service to your constituents. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Scott?
My name is Scott Bellows. I am a field volunteer with Portland Mountain Rescue. I'm a board member, my second term on the board of directors of Portland Mountain Rescue. I'm a former field volunteer with Eugene Mountain Rescue. I'm a wilderness first responder, and I'm a lawyer. I wanted to talk a little bit about more about who these search and rescue volunteers are, so you have a sense of the kind of commitment that we're making to provide services to the state. It's easy to think people who just show up for large searches in the woods. In Portland Mountain Rescue's case, for instance, we call ourselves, I think with good reason, volunteer professionals. We're members of the Mountain Rescue Association of America, which is a national organization. When we talk about teams going from state to state to help each other, that's part of a national organization where every search and rescue team is regularly recertified and tested by other teams. The MRA is celebrating its 50th anniversary next month at Timberline Lodge, where it was first formed. And yet Oregon is a state that other states' teams are reluctant to come to because we don't offer workers' comp protection to their volunteers. That's inconsistent with our historical role in that association. Our members donate thousands of hours, both in training and in missions, to the state. To be a PMR member, you have to go through a 2-year training academy. You have to do continuing education once or twice a month in various aspects of rescue, patient medical care, search management. We've all had to come up to speed on new bureaucratic requirements post 9/11 for how search management and incident command are handled. We don't get any government money for either our team or our personal gear. You know, personally, I've had 10-plus days of wilderness medical training, even though I'm not a medical professional, 7 days, full days of rigging classes, live helicopter training, classroom helicopter and fixed wing training required by the federal government, just recently completed a 5-day search management class. That's in addition to my initial certification and my ongoing requirements, and I'm a mid-level field person. I'm not a senior person in the field. I'm just a grunt. Portland Mountain Rescue's board's position, and you've got to understand, the board is very apolitical, or at least very diverse. We have people to the right of Toa of the Hun, and we have people who are, as Sean Penn put it at the Oscars, homo-loving commie son of a guns. But we decided to come out on this one and say the Portland Mountain Rescue supports this bill. It supports A4, adding back in the workers' comp coverage, and very specifically, we decided that the workers' comp only provision was worth fighting for. The biggest reason for us is that our volunteers risk not just medical injury, but also death or long-term disability. For instance, this weekend we had actually 3 incidents, only with two.
Scott, I'm going to need you to wrap up. I've got 2 more panels for this one. I apologize. Another bill.
When there's a person injured by ice fall or rock fall, we have to go into that area where there's ice fall or rock fall. When there's a helicopter rolling down the mountain, as there was a few years ago when that Black Hawk crashed, we had members that were ducking as pieces of rotor blade flew over their heads. We're talking about brain and spine injuries as a real possible injury for our workers, and we're not covered. Health insurance simply doesn't cover the kind of long-term costs that those require.
Quickly, on the
couple of counties that are opposing workers' comp coverage and want health insurance only, they're being penny wise and pound foolish, frankly, as well as a little ungrateful because there are a lot of tourist dollars brought in that we're helping sort of backstop. If a SAR volunteer is injured, the last thing they want to do is sue the county if the county played some role in their injury. But if I were injured and my family didn't have disability insurance, if my family couldn't afford long-term care, I might have to look at something like that. If long-term care and disability and death benefits are provided to my family, then I'm happy to be working with the county. Workers' comp gives the counties the liability protection that will, in the end, save them money. Health insurance does not. So I think that they're not thinking the whole thing through.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you all, gentlemen, for coming forward. My next panel is going to be Paul Snyder, Ed McClown, and Alex Kyler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and appearing this morning in support of House Bill 3021. Before we get into our testimony too deeply, I just want to reiterate again how important volunteers are to the counties. We can't do search and rescue work without the volunteers who support the effort. We appreciate what they do, and we try our best to do what we can for them. One issue, Mr. Chair, before we discuss the workers' comp medical insurance issue, there's one I think that's real easy, and that is to create a record with respect to ORS 401.515, and that's the written testimony that I handed out to the committee. ORS 401.515 says that, that neither the emergency service worker nor the public body have liability for negligence resulting in injury or damage to property or to people unless there's an element of misconduct, gross negligence, or bad faith. That statute is repealed by this bill. There's a federal law that's called the Volunteer Protection Act, passed in 1997. That law says that volunteers are immune from liability when they act basically under the same circumstances as I just described in ORS 401.515. It goes on to say that it preempts state law insofar as state law contradicts it, and then it says that it does not affect the liability of a government entity with respect to harm caused to another person. That's all in the federal law. ORS 30.265 says that a public body is immune basically if its agents are immune. I'm paraphrasing, but I've got that subsection listed here specifically. And so what we want to do with this, legislative council, everybody that I've talked to, law commission staff, legislative council, myself, and others, believe that these statutes all taken together would kick 30.265 in so as to extend the liability protections that the volunteers enjoy under federal law, would extend it also to the public body for whom they operate. Legislative Council doesn't like amendments to be offered that say things like, and we mean it. So therefore, we're not offering the A5 amendments. Basically, we're creating a record. We hope that if the committee passes the bill out with respect to the repeal of 401.515, that that will be the record on which the committee relies as the basis for the intent of that repeal. The workers' comp and unemployment, or excuse me, and medical insurance issues, there are a couple of things that I'd just like to mention. My understanding, I was also at the MLAC meeting last Friday, my understanding of the motion that was passed was to support either an amendment to Section 14 that restricts its application to workers' compensation only, or delete Section 14. I believe that was the motion that was passed by MLAC, and their motion was to support with that change, one or the other. And they didn't offer which one they would prefer. They just said one or the other. On workers' comp versus medical insurance, Mr. Chair, we discovered yesterday there are actually five counties that we know of that are affected by the workers' comp mandate that's in this bill. Up until yesterday, I thought I was only talking about two. But there are at least five, and they are Clackamas, and Lane, and Jackson, and Douglas, and Deschutes. With respect to the issue, I think you'll hear from Mr. McGlone's that the A8 and A9 amendments, or at least the A8 amendments, are offered to give some specificity to the medical insurance provision offered by that county, so it would apply across the board and provide a minimum of $100,000 medical insurance. I understand that that's secondary coverage. And it would also include a disability component and also accidental death provision. So Mr. McGlone will discuss those, and I hope that would provide us a significant amount of room moving in the direction of what search and rescue volunteer folks have testified to in terms of what they want.
All right, let me tell you where we're going to be on this. First of all, we got these amendments that none of us have seen, so there's going to be another work group. It's going to have to happen pretty quick. So what I want is an overview. I don't want to go in great detail because we're not making a decision today. We don't have everything in front of us. We don't have everyone at the table to do this. And so we're going to have another little work group that everyone's going to get together to review this. And then we're going to decide on whether or either any of these or do we need a subsequent set of amendments to deal with it. It's the chair's position. We are moving a bill. We are going to try to figure out what is the best that we can do. And we do have a very limited amount of time. So with that, I want us to get an overview of what the amendments are. We're not going to go back and forth over it just because we got more work to be done on this before we can actually move it. All right? All right. Ed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Edward McLone. I'm an assistant county counsel or senior assistant county counsel in Clackamas County. Held that position for about 9 years now. In that role, I am primary counsel to the sheriff's office, including on general risk management issues for the county. I've done tort litigation for 22 years now, I think it is, and that's the primary function I serve in the county is litigation and tort matters. Clackamas County is in a unique position here in that it does the most search and rescue operations in the state. According to the state, we did 118 operational missions last year, which is approximately 15% of all the missions done in the state. It's more than a number of counties combined do. And the counties that Mr. Snyder just listed, those are five, including Clackamas County, of the top six counties in the state that do search and rescue and are responsible for half of the operational missions in the state. So there's the Section 14 amendments have a significant impact on our county and these counties, and what we're trying to do is find a way to give the search and rescue volunteers the benefit or the protection that they deserve and we agree they deserve while finding a way that we can ensure this risk or adequately provide for it. There's a few difficulties with this, and one is the Volunteer Act, the federal act that Mr. Snyder mentioned. To have those protections, you cannot receive compensation beyond $500 a year or room, board, and other expenses. So we need to make sure that we do this in a manner that these amendments are one of two things. Either they are, or clearly that they're not compensation, and that can be done either because this is compensation for an expense incurred, in this case an injury suffered in the course of work, or it could be that this committee and the legislature determines that as a risk management principle, the county should provide this protection because the federal law allows you to make that decision, and that would not be considered remuneration in that circumstance. At least that's our opinion. Just a quick overview of these rules. The Dash 8 and the Dash 9 are meant to be alternatives. Or, if we were lucky, we'd get both, but we're not necessarily expecting that. Prior to Section 14, the language in those amendments, contrary to what was represented by law counsel, does not relate to workers' comp, but relates to the Volunteer Protection Act. We want to make sure that there isn't a claim down the road that one of these volunteers that's protected under the Act is not protected because they're receiving some form of compensation that goes beyond what the federal law allows. Starting in Section 14 in the Dash 8 amendments, we're proposing an amendment to 14A, amendment to the provision in the workers' comp law that allows counties to insure volunteers to require that state provide that coverage to self-insured employers without requiring us to convert our entire workforce to insurance.
Okay.
And
And that's what that's intended to do, and the legislative council felt that was the best way to address that issue.
The Dash 9 amendment provides for the legislature to specify a minimum level of medical benefit that must be provided. In this draft, it's $100,000 for hospital and medical, $250 per week for 52 weeks for disability, and $500,000 for accidental death and dismemberment. Depending on what county you're dealing with, these may be more generous or less generous in individual levels, but overall, this is more generous than what's currently provided. It's definitely more generous than what the county, Clackamas County already voluntarily provides. Key to this is the disability element, which is not in the current policies. That's a concern of the search and rescue people. It's legitimate. We want to be able to address that. We also provide that this can be provided either through insurance or self-insurance. At the current time, we think there's a product on the market that will fit this need, but we have not been able to confirm it, so we needed that flexibility so that if there isn't something that 100% fits the requirement, we can self-fund that requirement. And that is the quick overview of this.
Excellent. All right, so Alex, I'd like to, if you need to add anything else, that's fine. And like I said, we are going to put this in a work group, and that's where I think questions are going to need to come back, because there's just too much here for us to try to resolve. This isn't persuasive now. It's let's get the rest of the stuff before us, then we'll figure out where we go.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and the only thing that I'd add is to just to address what Clackamas's counsel just addressed was the limits that are specified in the A9 amendments. Lane County does provide, through an agreement with search and rescue volunteers, that we will provide that insurance. It's not quite the same as the level specified in the bill. Our current levels are $25,000 for unallocated expenses, $300 per week of lost time, and then a $20,000 accidental death benefit. So you can see how it varies. Now, we did contact our provider for that insurance, and we can't get something that's identical, or at least it's not offered, that's in the bill. And excuse me, for what we have existing, it's about $6,000 a year. It covers up to 200 volunteers. And to get somewhat close to what's offered in the amendment, which is $100,000 medical, the $300 weekly benefit, and then the life stayed at $20,000, that would more than double the cost, about $15,000 a year. So just to give the committee some sense of sort of how that progresses upward in terms of an expense to cover up to 200 volunteers.
Okay, thank you. Now, does anyone have questions that we need to put on the record at this point?
One comment, and I would like, before we vote on this bill eventually, I would like to make sure that the Law Commission concurs with Mr. Snyder's evaluation that the federal law does prevail after the repeal of 401-515, that's a federal law under 42 U.S.C. 1450-03 will prevail.
Okay, and I agree. What we're going to do at this point is I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the public hearing, or close it, but I'm going to have a work group. There's going to be point person will be Anna Braun, our counsel for this bill. And then myself and Senator Volquist will be available if necessary. I believe there's enough people in this room that have interest in here. Y'all can sit down. We'll coordinate and get the meeting set up, and we'll just figure out what's on the table. I definitely want the Law Commission involved in this project. And then also we'd like to have DCBS, Workers' Comp, and if we want a provider in the room too, because we need to know what are our options are. Can we do the whole meal deal? Or can we do parts of it, whatever it is, but something's going to happen so we can move this forward. All right, any other comments from the committee? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to close the public hearing at this time on House Bill 3021. We're going to open up our last public hearing, which is on House Bill 3343A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3343A changes penalties for employees of off-premises sales licensees who sell liquor to a minor. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and there's no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We have, looks like, five people that have signed up that want to give testimony. All of them are in favor. So as we come up, hopefully this will be a kumbaya. Jeff Anderson, Rod Brown,
and Tom Irwin will be our first, and then we'll come back with Sean and Mary as our closers. And as y'all are coming up, knowing the time that we have here, we have about 10 minutes before we need to close the committee for today. So if you can be succinct and not be repetitive, that would be great.
Yeah.
Chair, would it be okay if we, would it be okay if I had Elizabeth Kushwa join me in our testimony?
You can have her come up. I may not.
Okay. Chairman, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm Secretary Treasurer of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. We're a statewide in Southwest Washington-based local. We have 19,000 members, primarily in the grocery industry, in the retail sector. And we are in support of House Bill 3343A. We are also supportive of a amendment that we want to talk about. House Bill 3343 corrects a problem that has plagued, if you would, my membership for a lot of years. We have a standard of where we support the public purpose of keeping alcohol away from minors. We are very supportive of that. But one of the cause effects of the current law is that a grocery clerk inadvertently sells to a minor, not intentionally, but inadvertently, ends up being cited and summarily fired from their employment. Then they also have a misdemeanor criminal law, and they cannot be reemployed in the industry. And it's a first offense that takes a place in our industry where we are losing 20 and 30-year grocery clerks literally being losing their livelihood. And this corrects that by moving it to a process where we have state-approved training recognized. If these people go through state-approved OLCC training, that it would move to a citation system on a first and second offense, with a third offense being a criminal penalty. So it pushes back the penalty. In our industry, the handling cash or irregularity is a very strict, held by arbitrators, that people can lose their job literally on a first offense. And this just simply corrects a problem where we've lost scores of our members who inadvertently sell to alcohol. And I think what I'd like to do is have our member Rod Brown, who works at a Safeway locally here, talk a little bit about his perceptions of why we need this bill.
All right, let me just clarify. We're all here. I know everyone's here to support the bill. I don't think there's any opposition on that. So with that, I'm trying to save us some time and move through, make sure we get the testimony we need so we can preserve this and move forward. I know there's an amendment coming, so we're not going to be able to do that. And unless y'all want to have people come back, and our schedules for the next 3 days or 4 days is going to be pretty tight. So,
understand.
All right. Okay, Rod?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brzezinski and board. This would allow for a obvious mistake to be handled in a much or less severe penalty, where the employee would be a breadwinner still in this community, and the state instruction and schooling that I think would be very beneficial as a standard. It would be very standardized then, and through all our clerks. And I think this would be a very beneficial.
Great. And so basically this will actually give you the framework that you haven't had, and give you the training that you think all of you should have.
I think at least it gets it more standard and provided by the state.
Right. Tom?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We worked with the sponsors of the legislation, United Food and Commercial Workers, and their representatives to help come up with the language that you see in the engrossed version, and we're very supportive of that and feel like it's a good step and a good move in the right direction to help get people trained and get the education that they need to be able to identify false identification, people that are minors, et cetera, and it's on a voluntary basis in many respects, either The employee themselves can make the effort to do that, or they are in an employer arrangement where that's already being taken care of for them in terms of the training that's provided, as long as it's approved by the agency. So we're in favor of this bill.
Oh, thank you. Elizabeth, did you have something to add?
I just wanted to quickly let the committee know that because the training is not standardized across the industry, that's why this is so important. There are people who have training programs for their companies. They're not... Elizabeth Bourgeois for UFCW. There are people who are not being trained in approved programs, and so this will address that. The amendment we are bringing, are having drafted now, is pretty simple. Because we go violation, violation, and then it makes a big leap to 30 days in jail, we wanted an intermediary step to violation, violation, $1,000, and then $1,000 and 30 days in jail. So that's the amendment. It's pretty simple.
Okay.
If you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer them.
And let me ask, are there any questions for anyone on this panel?
No, Mr. Chair, good bill. We just need to get it moving.
Right. All right. Thank you all very much. The last two that we have scheduled to give testimony, Sean Miller and Mary Botkin. And again, if y'all can be brief, that would be wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. I just want to say that we are in support of House Bill 3343, hope that the bill moves forward. We're supportive of the amendment that's coming forward, and we're just here to support the food commercial workers. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Sean.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. We worked with the agency, which we represent, and the industry for many years to bring this bill forward to you. We think it's a great idea, and the amendment's fine with us as well.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Not seeing any. We're closing the public hearing on House Bill 3343, waiting for our amendment to come back. We'll have that rescheduled this next week, more than likely. And then we're going to open up a work session on our final bill for the day, 2870A.
I was just going to introduce the bill, House Bill 2870A. You heard on May 15th that adds aggravated vehicular homicide, criminally negligent homicide with a vehicle, and manslaughter in first and second degree involving a motor vehicle to a list of convictions that require permanent driver's license revocation, no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment.
Mr. Chair, move HB 2870 to the floor with a due pass.
Senate Bill question is House Bill 2870A. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions, discussion?
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. We took the time or between the last meeting to look at the interlock issue. Bottom line is I emailed you and other committee members is we couldn't get there from here because we didn't have enough data from legislative fiscal and background to try and address that issue. And I've talked to the sponsors and the supporters of the bill, and we're going to come back next session and try and, you know, resolve the whole issue and get more interlocks into the system.
All right. Well, thank you to you and Senator Dingfelder for taking the time to look at this issue. I know it's important for many of us, and that this is something we'll try to put into our play during the interim to see if we can get the additional data and see if we can't move forward on this. Any other comments? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. The chair will carry the bill. And that concludes the work on the House Bill 2870A. So we'll close that work. And I believe that takes care of our work for today.
Yeah.
And so, colleagues, I want to thank y'all for the extra effort you're putting in this week and into the next week. I know this is very task-driven as to the amount of bills we have, but I hope that the House realizes what we're doing in the sense of my understanding. We've moved 57 bills so far, and we probably have another 50 that we'll be considering. So with that, thank you very much, and we're adjourned for today until 8 in the morning.